In 16th century Italy, it was custom to bestow the title of virtuoso on the most distinguished artists of the day. And in the decades that followed, from Mozart to Hendrix, it was a musician's ability to play and perform that was revered above all else. But by the 1970s, technology began to emerge, which directly challenged how we define musicianship. I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd, and you're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. In this week's programme, I'm telling the story of the sampler and the drum machine, and the music which emerged following their invention. And it was in the suburbs of Sydney, Australia, in the 1950s, where an inquisitive young boy would grow up to help kickstart this musical revolution.
I had a childhood fascination with electronics or electricity from, I'm told, before I could walk, I was finding metal things to put into PowerPoints because I enjoyed getting electric shocks. And my parents' response to this was to buy those little plastic plugs that you put into the PowerPoint so that you can't put things in there. And that motivated me to develop an interest in the use of tools in order to extract said plugs so that I could then put metal things into the PowerPoint.
As a boy, Peter Vogel had a singular hobby in electronics. Be it building computers or robots, he had little time for anything else.
I came from a musical family. I did start learning a number of instruments from time to time, and I sort of had a go at them up to the point that they became really difficult and time-consuming, and then it started to eat into my nerd time. So it was really a fascination with electronics more than music. But at the time, sort of early 70s, when the Moog synthesizer sort of became popularized, I was very excited to hear that it was possible to make music electronically.
Peter Vogel had a school friend, Kim Rari, who shared this excitement, and he proposed to Peter that they try building their own synth. Not long out of high school, the pair teamed up with another engineer, Tony Furze, who'd already been designing synths at the Canberra School of Music, and the three of them went about building a new instrument, which, they hoped, would sound like nothing else.
There were limitations to the types of sound at that time, in that electronic sounds always sounded electronic, and they were great sounds and you could sculpt them in various ways, but it certainly wasn't an infinite palette. I just had this idea that if you want to make it sound like a piano, I wonder if we can actually take a sample from a piano sound and put it in the memory and play it back, and that should sound pretty much like a piano. And sampled a tiny fragment off a vinyl record and played it back, and not surprisingly, it sounded pretty much like the original. We were then sampling everything we could lay our hands on and seeing what happened when you changed the pitch, and the results were generally pretty exciting.
This wasn't an entirely original idea, though. There was an instrument already on the market called the Mellotron, which replayed a range of sampled sounds such as the violin and the cello. These samples were stored on magnetic tape, which were played back through the Mellotron's piano-style keyboard, and it was popular during the 60s and 70s, with stars such as David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, and my band, Pink Floyd, where we used it on our album, Saucer Full of Secrets. But one of the Mellotron's most famous appearances is the flute sound used in the intro of Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles.
Let me take you down.
There were other experiments going on in the 1970s to build machines which replicated the sounds of traditional instruments. These were complicated systems using oscillators designed to recreate sounds from scratch. But Peter Vogel's idea was much more simple. Just record the sound of a real instrument and store it on a computer. In fact, why not build a machine where you could record any sound you want and play it back on a keyboard?
So it was really a way of cutting corners and getting a really interesting and complicated sound into the memory to start with, which you could play as it was if you wanted your keyboard just to sound like a piano or a violin or something, or you could mess with it and make sounds that no one had ever heard before. We had no concept of how it was going to be used. It was just a classic build it and they will come sort of philosophy, and it was more luck than good management that this thing ever saw the light of day.
And that luck happened to be living right next door to Peter Vogel's friend, Kim Ryrie.
Just by coincidence, Kim's next-door neighbour when he was a kid was a fellow called Bruce Jackson. And Bruce had gone off to pursue a career as a sound engineer. And he had, by that time, ended up being Elvis Presley's engineer. And when Elvis died, Bruce came home to visit his family. We were building our prototype right next door to where Bruce's family lived. And his folks said, oh, you ought to go next door and see what Kim's doing. He's doing something with sound and music. So Bruce popped over and we showed him the prototype. And he was just blown away. And he said, look, I'm at a bit of a loose end at the moment. How about I introduce you to some of my contacts in the US? And I thought, well, why not?
And in 1979, Peter Vogel took the prototype of the Fairlight CMI, short for Computer Musical Instrument, on a tour of America's top recording studios. Technically a synthesizer, the Fairlight was a huge leap forward in synth sound quality because of its sampling capability, as shown on the BBC's Tomorrow's World programme in 1980.
We've never been very good at electronically creating sounds that sound real. Listen to this. Well, that synthesizer is supposed to sound like a timpani drum. But does it sound like one? Well, judge for yourself. This is what a timpani drum sounds like. But now, cock an ear to this. It's a synthesizer too. And this is what it sounds like. Well, that's almost perfect, isn't it? And that's just the beginning. Listen. And even go up octaves. And now I'll speak into the mic. Hello.
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 I thought it was wonderful.
In the 70s and early 80s, this kind of computer technology didn't come cheap. And the starting price for the Fairlight was an eye-watering $50,000. Despite this, the Fairlight company's order book was filling up, and Peter Vogel was soon sending his synths to some of the biggest music stars in the world.
The first one I delivered was to Stevie Wonder, and I stayed for a couple of weeks with Peter Gabriel, and he introduced me to Kate Bush and some guys from Led Zeppelin. I went visited their studio somewhere. I remember a really nice studio in the country somewhere. I guess fortunately, in a way, I had no idea who these people were. Because I was so obsessed with electronics, I spent all my spare time, and I mean like all of it, tinkering with electronics. And I didn't have time to actually be across the sort of pop culture and music and so on. So I didn't know Peter Gabriel or Stevie Wonder from a bar of soap.
Another early adopter of the Fairlight was the British music producer Trevor Horn. During the 1980s, he worked with bands such as Frankie Goes to Hollywood and the Pet Shop Boys, as well as performing in his own band, The Art of Noise.
I mean, in the 70s, you know, nearly every record that you heard was keyboards, bass, guitar and drums. Suddenly there was like a new language. You could make sound effects into music. And I would lie in bed at night thinking of what we could do with it. Because we found that car engines and big engines, especially if we could get them starting up, was a great sound. It felt like really liked that. We would take one of those ooh, sound of a car engine. Hey! We would just keep collecting things, you know. There was loads of times where I just make a mental note, get that drum, you know, sample that thing to be used later on.
What set the Fairlight apart from other synths was that it came with a full-size computer monitor and a light pen. The idea was that not only could you record sounds directly into it, but you could draw sound waves onto the computer screen and design sounds by hand, a change from the knob-twiddling synthesis of the past. Nick Rhodes plays keyboards in Duran Duran and was among the first to buy a Fairlight back in the early 80s.
On most of the analog synths, I made more sounds than I ever used. With the Fairlight, it was quite a process. You could easily layer sounds together, but the dream of drawing the sound wave on the screen sounded great in principle, but the actual sound was pretty awful and usually just sounded like something that was broken.
Fortunately, the Fairlight also came with a set of floppy disks, which each stored 16 preloaded sounds, largely made up of orchestral instruments.
It was the brass, the strings, we all liked the marimbas and xylophones, things like that. And it brought something new to music because you've got another palette. You've got all these colours and somebody changes the colour of the sky completely and says, oh, you can have that too. You want to paint with that. But we did end up using some of the similar sounds.
And there was one sound in particular which would really come to define the Fairlight's legacy. And its origins lie with the 20th century Russian composer Igor Stravinsky. Stravinsky's Firebird Suite was written for the Russian Ballet in 1910. And 70 years later, a snippet made its way into the Fairlight's floppy disk library. Peter Vogel.
The one that probably turned out to be most iconic and most successful was a thing called Orc 2. The names aren't terribly descriptive because the technology only allowed us to use 8 characters in a file name at that stage. So Orc 2 is a sample of an orchestral stab. It's like the whole orchestra playing a chord, and it became a very iconic sound which has appeared on hundreds and hundreds of hits.
And these hits include songs by Janet Jackson, U2, and more recently by Bruno Mars and Cardi B. But one man who played a bigger role than most in popularising the Fairlight's Orc 2 sample is music producer Trevor Horn.
The Orc stab was like a revelation, you know? I loved it. I mean, what a fabulous modern sound. It's so dramatic. Moments in Love definitely had the Orc stab on it. Dang, 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 dang. By the time I was doing Owner of a Lonely Heart, which would have been 83, we didn't just have one Orc stab. I had about 3 or 4 different ones. And all of the bang, da li li yang stuff on Owner of a Lonely Heart is various Orc stabs. I liked it so much that by the time we got to Two Tribes, I was doing them for real with the full orchestra and putting that into the sampler.
Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood sold close to 2 million copies in the UK, making it one of the best-selling singles of the 1980s. But while the Fairlight had a huge cultural impact, sales remained exceptionally modest, and it's estimated only a few hundred were ever sold. Furthermore, there was a more powerful rival on the market in the American-made Synclavier, which could record higher quality samples at a longer running time.
So there's the Fairlight. It does 8 seconds in sampled sound. The Synclavier did 69 seconds. Better quality almost than anything else that was available, but incredibly tricky to program. The day that I actually bought a Fairlight, the Synclavier called me up. Trevor, I just heard you're buying a Fairlight. I just want to tell you, Fairlight, if you're looking for gimmicks, then the Fairlight's the machine for you. But if you're looking for a serious scientific instrument that's going to help you make records, then you must get the Syncopia. I said, I'm looking for gimmicks, man. I'm going to buy the Fairlight's, which is exactly what I did. Thank God. I bought a Synclavier a couple of years later, and actually Two Tribes has got a lot of Synclavier on it, but the problem, you know, was nowhere near as exciting, ludicrously complicated for what it was.
While it was technically more advanced, the Synclavier was left in the shadow of the Fairlight because it had a much more intuitive operating system, not to mention being half the price. The potential of sampling technology in making music was inspiring other inventors too. Among them was Roger Lynn, a songwriter and sound engineer living in Los Angeles.
I would make my songwriting and production demos at my little home studio in one room of a rented house in Los Angeles. I played guitar, I could also play bass, and I played a little bit of keyboards. But the hardest thing for me to record and to play were the drums. And so I started thinking about how could I make a better drum machine than those that existed at the time. And there were other drum machines, and they had one button for rock one and rock two. Rock two went but they weren't programmable, and the sounds are pretty bad. And so I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could make a better one? And then there were some academic papers at the time about this new idea of sampled sounds. And so I figured if I only needed to store a very, very short amount of sound, one snare drum, one bass drum, one hi-hat, then the very expensive computer memory at the time wouldn't be so expensive, and so maybe it was doable.
And so in 1979, Roger Lynn set to work and called in a favour from a friend to record the drum sounds he needed to sample.
He came over, and in my home studio, I just put him in a closet with each drum and a microphone on it, and I would be in my little control room, which is just another bedroom in the house. And so I'd say, okay, I'm rolling, go ahead and hit the drum, and he'd hit it once. And that was the session. Thank you very much. My intent was to create a machine that sounded as close as possible to some of the great drummers that I had listened to on recordings over the years. So there were two things that were required. Number one was the real sounds, and the second thing was the ability to have the same sort of rhythmic feel so that someone could make a very natural sounding groove. What makes it sound more human, more natural, is the variation in loudness from one strike to the next of a hi-hat cymbal or of a snare drum. And so I thought that's something that I could just do in software in the drum machine. It would sound more natural than one of those earlier machines.
And soon, a prototype of the LM1 drum computer was ready. It was a huge advance on the tinny, toy-sounding drum machines on the market at the time. This, combined with its programmability, meaning you could compose your own beat, meant word spread quickly across the studios of LA.
I would take the prototype down to someone's studio, and they would just press the button and they would hear a real recording of a snare drum come out, or a bass drum. And they found this just to be magical. And so they would often say, well, I'd like to have one. May I have one? And I said, well, sure. It'll be about 3 months, and I need a 50% deposit. Now, at that time, I was selling them for $5,000 each, which in 1979, I mean, it's a lot of money now, but it was a whole lot of money then. And when I showed this to them, by the way, it was a cardboard box with some circuit boards in it and wires hanging out of it, but it would make the sounds. And I said, oh, I just have to put it in a box and I have to finish this. I announced them and we're starting to take deposits in 1979, but I didn't deliver them until 1980.
As a drummer myself, I'm slightly puzzled as to why you'd need such a thing. But it seems there were a lot of people who could see the benefit. Among them was Trevor Horn.
Have you met drummers? My experience, right, when I started producing in 75, 76, back then people couldn't play in time. I mean, they couldn't play in time. Suddenly having a Lynn in time, perfectly in time, was heaven. And, you know, to record a drum kit in any kind of proper way, you're going to need at least 8 mics and a few compressors and a couple of limiters. And that all takes time to set up. Then you've got to deal with a bullshit drummer. So, you know, the drum machine was like from heaven.
The LM1 was a hit, at least among those artists who could afford it, which included many of the biggest stars of the early 80s.
The people they went to, it was pretty much a who's who of musicians at the time. Peter Gabriel, Genesis, Madonna, and the artist who I think advanced the adoption of my early drum machines the most was Prince.
It has been said that Prince was a genius with drum machines. He certainly was. He could come up with so many new drum beats so quickly. I've watched others in the studio take 6 times longer.
Susan Rogers is a professor of music production at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, and also Prince's former sound engineer.
Prince sometimes used a live drummer. He sometimes played drums himself, but Prince, in the years when I was with him, from Purple Rain through Sign of the Times, preferred that LM1. The thing about a drum machine is that human beings notice things that change, and if things don't change in our environment, we tune it out. That's cognitively efficient. So it frees you up cognitively, and that can move your window of attention to something that is changing. Which might be a great keyboard performance, it might be a great guitar performance, it might be a great vocal performance. But having those drums just clocking like that, you can play this instrument in a way that a drummer couldn't play.
This is not really what was intended for the LM1 when Roger Lynn designed it, but not for the first time, artists had taken musical technology and repurposed it for their own ends.
My intent was to create a machine that sounded as close as possible to some of the great drummers that I had listened to on recordings over the years. You know, I was trying to get away from the rigidness of these early drum machines. My goal was to try and make the drums sound as natural and inhuman as possible. And it turned out that it became popular not to make the drums sound as natural and human as possible, but rather to make them sound as robotic and inhuman as possible. It became the style. And I think I learned at that point that, as I would put it, I'm just making the brush and the artist decides what to paint with it.
Coming up, the sampler and the drum machine come together to define the sound of hip-hop. And the drum machine increases its tempo as new genres of dance music emerge. That's on A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. This week, I'm telling the story of the sampler and the drum machine. With instruments like the Fairlight and Synclavier, it was possible to make music by replicating sounds from any source imaginable. While the Linn drum brought speed and precision to the studio with its programmable beats. And at the time this technology began to emerge, a new sound was coming out of New York, which proved a perfect partner for it.
I said a hip hop, the hippie to the hip hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie, say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
Hip hop was the ultimate magpie music, with early rap records borrowing the beats and melodies of existing hits.
That was rap from day one. You know, you didn't make your own track. You know, rap was rapping over other people's records. That's what it was.
Arthur Baker is a music producer who cut his teeth in the disco era of the 70s, and in 1982 was hired to produce a track by hip-hop pioneer Afrika Bambaataa. The plan was to base the backing track on another hit, Trans-Europe Express, by the German band Kraftwerk.
We were going to use Trans-Europe Express melody and the beat, but then there was a new Kraftwerk record out, and it had a track called Numbers. And the beat came on, and I went, damn, this beat is really kicking, it's really different, and the sound, and it's just much cooler.
In the early days of hip-hop, beats and bass lines weren't sampled straight from a record. That technology was still pretty exclusive. Instead, if you heard a beat you wanted to use, then you had to find someone to play it.
So we went and looked through the Village Voice. Obviously, it was way pre the internet. We looked on the music ads, and there was an ad, Man with Machine, Man with Drum Machine. So we called him up. His name was Joe. And I said, well, Joe, we're doing this session. We'll pay you $25. You come in with your drum machine. And I said, what kind of drum machine do you have? And he said, 808. And we had Joe program that beat.
The 808, or to give it its full name, the TR-808 Rhythm Composer, was a drum machine made by the Japanese company Roland and released in 1980. Its beats were made electronically rather than being real samples, and while it didn't really wow the music world in the same way Roger Lynn's LM1 had, it began to find some fans.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who went, oh, this doesn't sound like real drums, I'm not going to use it. We all said, we're going to use it because it sounds cooler than real drums. And, you know, it was funky. And it had these cool sounds. You know, the Lynn cowbells were, yeah, they sounded like real cowbells. But the 808 sounded like, you know, cowbells from outer space. But when we went in, the thing is, when we went in, nothing was decided. The production of Planet Rock was totally, we were experimenting in the studio. And we just happened to get it right. Yeah!
Planet Rock was a worldwide smash. One of the first hits to use the now familiar sound of the Fairlight Orchestra. It was also one of the first records to get dance floors bouncing to the sounds of the 808 drum machine.
We were sort of lucky we got the 808 that day, you know. It could have been a Lynn or a DMX, and the record would have sounded different. And then a lot of people were trying to do Planet Rock, and some of them didn't get it, and they were using like other drum machines, and it didn't really work. It really caught on in R&B. Obviously Marvin Gaye and Sexual Healing. Oh man, you know, when I heard the cowbell, I was like, oh my God, someone got an 808 on the radio, and I heard ding. I was like, oh. I thought it was our private drum machine. You know, it was just, it really depressed me. Because you knew immediately it was an 808, and I was like, God damn it.
But it was in New York's emerging hip-hop and electro scene of the mid-80s that the Roland TR-808 really started to gain traction. And one producer in particular would make his name with it, after stumbling across it in a recording studio.
When the record company had taken us into the studio, there was an 808 sitting there. But it was so expensive, and I'd never actually used one. I went and started playing around with it, and after that I fell in love with the machine.
Curtis Mantronic signed his first record deal while still a teenager, and would go on to score a string of international hits based around his pioneering polyrhythmic productions on the 808.
I was a cowbell king. Ding, 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 ding. And the clap. Boom, cha, 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 cha. It was synthetic, but it just had a feel of something that was unique. Arthur Baker was using it. A few other people were using it. But I thought the way they used it was, the production was very good, but I stripped it back. And it was very bare bones record, but it just worked. But I got to a stage where I sort of got a little bit tired of the sound of it. So then I started sampling it and manipulating it more. And that's where everything started to change.
By the mid-80s, sampling technology was shrinking in size and in price. While still not cheap, it was way less than the $200,000 price tag of the Synclavier. A number of compact but powerful machines began to emerge, including the all-in-one drum machine and sampler, the Emu SP-12. And among the first in line to buy one was Curtis Mantronic.
So I was always a sort of a gear junkie at the time. And I remember going into, it was a music store in New York called Sam Ash. They had just gotten these machines in. And the guy at the shop was saying, oh, this is a new sampling technology, blah, 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 blah. And I remember going in, the owner of the record company, Will Sokoloff, he accompanied me, and I said to Will, I want one. And he's like, Curtis, you know, this is like $4,000, $5,000. I can't just... And I said, Will, I really want this. He said, okay, let me speak to my partners and let's see what we can do about it. And then I think the following day we went in, we picked up the machine. Me having that SB12, that's the machine that changed everything for me. So I sampled everything and I sped things up, slowed things down, took bits and pieces and made musical notes, passages with the little bits of samples that I used. And that's what I pretty much use for all my productions. It's years and years later, and I'm very proud of this. It's a track I did called Bass Machine by Tila Rock.
Kicking it live on the Bass Machine, better known as the Roland 808. The king of the beats, we call him Madtronic, and I am Tila Rock.
That was one of the records that came out of that machine. They call that music today trap, with the triplet hi-hats and the 808 kick. You go back and you'll see where that pretty much came from.
What Curtis Mantronic and others had discovered was the 808's secret weapon. Its prolonged bass sound, made possible by tuning the bass kick to its maximum levels. Arthur Baker.
There's just a knob that you can tune it higher and lower, and you can make the decay go a lot longer. So it's like a sustain pedal. It's like, you know, in a piano, if you're going to sustain a note and you have the sustain, they have the sustain pedal all the way up. Instead of boom, it's boom.
Ironically, the success of the 808 was helped by the fact that it was a commercial failure. Originally priced at just over $1,000 when first released in 1980, it was discontinued in 1983 after disappointing sales. And many producers picked them up second-hand at a fraction of the price. But once pioneering producers like Arthur Baker and Curtis Mantronic had helped popularize its sound, it came to dominate dance music, and everybody wanted one. But it was too late.
I think probably I started getting asked about it a lot in 85 and 86 because of Miami bass.
You know, the ones with the cars that go, I hear you, hit it.
Richard Katz has sold Roland products in Florida since 1983.
Every car had Miami bass coming out of the windows. They wanted that decay to go forever. And all of a sudden I started hearing, do you know where I can find an 808? It became a fever. Very quickly they disappeared out of pawn shops and things like that.
They know we love the guys with the cars that go boom.
They were like trying to find a needle in a haystack. You could not find them anywhere. I think probably at this point, who knows, it could be $4,000 if you look on eBay right now.
While drum machines like the Roland 808 and others like the Oberheim DMX played a key part in early rap music, its origins remained in other people's records. DJs would cut together the instrumental sections of records, what are known as breaks, to create an infinite loop for people to dance to. Hank Shockley is a producer and founding member of the legendary hip-hop group Public Enemy.
Hip-hop started for me playing in the parks because there was no real place to hold it. So we were just playing outdoors. I would listen to Grandmaster Flowers and the Ron Plumbers and the Pete DJ Jones, and they would all be playing in the park, but they'll be in four different corners of the park. And they're all playing at the same time. And when the place is packed, you can only hear the area that you're closest to. But I would go out and stand in somewhere near the middle because what I wanted to hear how all the sounds came together. And there were moments, like for a brief second, all of a sudden all the sound would work together in the same rhythm. That's the area that I wanted to explore the most.
But Hank Shockley's ambitions were hampered by the fact that many of the early samplers had exceptionally limited memory, restricting the number of samples a producer could work with at any given time. But as sampling technology improved, the relationship between rappers and records was about to become much more complex.
The first sampler that I got a hold of was a company out of Japan called Korg, called the DDD-1. And it was affordable. You know, you didn't have to spend thousands of dollars to get it. But it only gave you a second of one pad and a second on another. So that was only enough to give you like a kick and a snare. And then I guess from there, you want more. And I found this, it was made by Insonic. It was called the Mirage. And it gave you 3 seconds of sample time. So now I can do something on top of the drum patterns that can add some extra textures. And that was what we used on Rebel Without a Pause, My Uzi Weighs a Ton. A lot of those early records were done just from the Korg DDD-1 and Sonic Mirage. And so I was in the recording studio and the engineer said, hey, we just got this brand new sampler in. It's the Akai S900. This thing will give you 32 seconds of sound. I was like, are you kidding me? Having that extra sampler, you know, gave me the opportunity now to layer some things together and do some things that really wasn't really done.
Public Enemy broke new ground in their sample-driven production style, molding tracks from snippets taken from a mass of songs, speeches, and sound effects to create high-density sonic tapestries.
The backdrop for creating soundscapes with sound comes from the fact that I would listen to a lot of Yes records, Pink Floyd, and you've always heard these textures and things going on. Took you into a different space, and you was almost into some atmosphere that was well beyond what was reality.
And the way Public Enemy went about making their sample soundscapes was the reverse of how many musicians might work.
Going into the studio, we would always start with the title first, because the title gives you the window into, okay, this is what this is not. That's all the title says. So when you have a title like My Uzi Weighs a Ton, you already know what's not in that. So anything that's harmonically pleasing, anything that's about love and cherishment and anything sappy will not work. How that comes together, every man on a turntable, and we're all finding pieces and snatches and seeing what doesn't work and what does work.
This is a journey.
Keep in mind that all this was done out of the necessity of the fact that we couldn't afford to have musicians. Musicians was too expensive and wasn't in our budget. And we didn't know how to play. So we had to figure out a way to kind of like get the same energy through using records, so to speak. And it's the records that I realized that through my collection that I have the best musicians money can buy.
As record sampling and drum machines became more prominent in the 1980s, it wasn't without controversy. In the early days, it was something of a Wild West, as hit records were made with samples taken without permission, which led to numerous court cases and accusations that making tracks by sampling records wasn't real music. But it was a time of great innovation too, from both the musicians pioneering new genres and the companies coming up with new instruments. And there's another machine that's worth a mention here. After the belated success of the TR-808, which Roland was unable to cash in on, big things were expected of its new drum machine, the Roland TR-909, first released in 1983. Richard Katz, Roland's rep in Florida, had to sell the new machines.
It was critically important that you had the guys in the stores, these big stores, working with you. It would be Manny's and Sam Ash in New York. You had Washington Music and Veneman in Washington. You had Rhythm City in Atlanta. You had Ace Music, who I called on in Miami. And these were the top stores in the country. And there was no internet, and they would do an outsized amount of the business.
So, no pressure then when it came to demonstrating the new Roland 909.
I remember being very nervous. I could see it in the room. It was a studio room. It was set up there and it had great studio monitors to make sure it sounded good. And all the guys were crowded around, and I started hitting the snare and it went boop, you know, and I hit the toms and went bloop, 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 you know. And I'll never forget Walt Bernstein, who was the top salesman there, and he was the guy that everybody went to. It was either the Bee Gees or Philip Michael Thomas from Miami Vice was in there all the time, and Casey and the Sunshine Band. And I remember going through all this and all these sounds, and kind of a cold sweat feeling came over me, and Walt said, just doesn't sound very good.
And so, like its predecessor, the 808, the Roland TR-909 drum machine was a commercial flop. But also, like the 808, this initial failure meant that there were plenty of 909s to be bought on the cheap, which again found their way into the hands of innovators, this time involved in a new sound coming out of Chicago.
You know, everyone looks for a definition of what house music is. You know, the best definition you can give someone is house is a feeling.
House music pioneer Jesse Saunders.
You can have many different, say, drum machines or whatever, program the same sounds in them, and it'll give you a totally different vibe every time. 909 actually will probably be the most significant one. I think that the 808, the kick drum you can never quite make as tight and as punchy as you could do the 909, which is why it became more of a standard. It was cheap then, a couple hundred dollars.
But the Roland TR-909 really came into its own in Detroit, the birthplace of techno.
We were on the same wavelength as what was happening in Chicago, except our thing was much more electronic. It wasn't attached to vocals, and it wasn't attached to disco. The Chicago scene was much more attached to that. We were attached to the industrial side of the music, to the minimalist side of the music.
Derek May is one of the godfathers of Detroit techno.
The 909, it was powerful. It presented a level of dance floor power that could not be denied. People just ran to the dance floor. They went crazy. I mean, we just destroyed the party. I mean, no DJ could play after that. That machine was unprecedented in the presence that it gave you on a song. It almost sounds like an earthquake controlled in a machine. If you use it properly, it's unlimited. It's raw. The toms, the hi-hat, the rim shots. It's a very dynamic machine, and it just really set everything apart. And that's why we loved it so much. It became the signature of Detroit techno.
Within the space of a decade or so, between the 1980s and 1990s, making music with samplers and drum machines had spawned numerous new musical movements, from hip-hop to house to techno to acid and bass music and more. But what was particularly striking is how versatile a single sample could be in the hands of different producers. Take this song. Amen, Brother, by the Winstons, was released in 1969, a B-side to their single Colour Him Father. By the 1980s, it was rediscovered by rap producers who began to make use of its drum break. What became known as the Amen break, Curtis Mantronic was among the first to popularise it with his hit King of the Beats, released in 1988.
King of the Beats was supposed to be a show opener for Mantronics, and I just went through records and I sampled bits of this and bits of that. You know, for me, it wasn't anything special. I just sort of put it in, chopped it up a little bit, put the siren behind it. And I remember when I put that thing on, the siren came on. So everyone's like, oh, it's a siren. You didn't see anyone's sort of reaction. And then when the Amen beat dropped, the place just absolutely exploded.
And the Amen break would go on to be used in numerous rap records, from Rob Bass.
Keep it going now.
To Salt and Pepper.
Tell 'em why, Pepper, tell 'em why.
'Cause I desire, desire.
And N.W.A.
Straight out of Compton, it's a crazy brother named Ice Cube. I'm the stupid dope gang with an attitude.
But it was when it reached the shores of the UK that it found a new lease of life.
Growing up in the 80s, it was always about hearing this sound. I remember I used to listen to hip-hop music, hear these 808 bass lines. I'm like, what on earth is that?
Ronnie Size grew up in Bristol in the southwest of England, where he first got to grips producing music in the local youth centre. In the early 90s, he was an instrumental player in the emergence of a distinct new form of dance music.
We was influenced by reggae from Jamaica, hip-hop from America, and always kind of like copying what was going on in these other countries. But the thing I noticed about my music, it started to speed up a little bit. I started to hear house music, then acid house, then techno. My music was always a little bit more energetic than the stuff that was coming from, say, the States or from coming from Jamaica. I was like, right, that's got potential to be a UK identity. I loved it straight away.
Initially known as Jungle, and later morphing into drum and bass, the backbone to this new music was a very familiar beat.
Amen Brothers, for me, it did define the sound of jungle and drum and bass. Yeah, Amen Brothers was like the one which sounded like no other, and there will never be another break that sounds like that break or can do what that break does.
Jungle producers also innovated using samplers, especially those made by the Japanese company Akai, which came with a very specific sonic effect.
In the genre which I'm known for, which is jungle and drum and bass, time stretching was this one key element which just gave it its identity. You know, you took a vocal and you stretched it and it just sounded a certain way. It was only in drum and bass and jungle that started that.
What the time you have the dread?
Then what when a gunman back me up round the corner?
With the Akai, look for the icon that said time stretch and you taking 808 bass lines, but then there's thought in them. You see what comes out and it's a new world. It was like Mars. No one's ever been there before. It was incredible to be able to, you know, to snatch elements from different places and to make them unrecognizable and to give it your own imprint. That was a beautiful thing.
The invention of the drum machine and the sampler led to a seismic change in music making. Together, they ushered in an era where the imagination, rather than the ability to play an instrument, could be the fuel for musical innovation. This led to one of the most productive periods in popular music, as a series of new sounds and musical scenes emerged around the world, forging new genres which would have been impossible to make had it not been for the advent of this new technology. Next week, we begin the story of the recording studio.
At first, they existed to capture sounds and reproduce them as faithfully as possible.
But artists do what they want to do to get the sounds that somehow move them. They discovered that if you push all four buttons in at once, which was never intended, it sounded cool.
You've been listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The program was mixed by James Beard and produced by Richard Fenton Smith. The editor is Jasper Corbett. This program was made in association with the Open University.